I should spend several
at Jack Straw Studios, and it's Tuesday, January 19th, 2016. I'm here with Ken Crable, who's the director of the Center for Social Innovation. No, you're not? Well, we'll get into what you do. Okay, so I'm here with Ken Crable. And Ken, as we were talking before, this is for the Skid Road Oral History Project. And it's looking at the trying to increase an understanding of the complexity of charity, healthcare charity, with little, quotation marks around it, in King County, Washington. So the first question I have for you is, what led you to the work that you do, whatever it is that you're doing now?
Well, that's actually one of the big mysteries in my life, frankly. I've pondered that a lot. And I grew up in a chicken farm in Pennsylvania, which was a very small world. And I was brought up with an interest in the neighbor, an interest in people in general, although it was the neighbor who was mostly like me. It wasn't someone living in poverty or homeless. I didn't know anything of homelessness, except there was a rescue mission that my parents were somewhat involved in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And I suppose that laid some seeds for me. The other thing I think about is that I was given responsibility to take care of a small group of chickens that had stopped laying eggs.
And you were about how old then, would you
say?
Oh,
I was, 7, 8, 9 maybe. Mm-hmm. And these were, we called them culls, C-U-L-L-S, which meant that they weren't laying and they needed to be taken care of and coaxed back into productivity. And so I sometimes think, well, maybe that was part of it, but there's always been something for me that has attracted me to people in the margins. And I don't know if there's a logical explanation for that. It's just sort of, I think I was born with that. So for me, I took the slow route through college, took 7 or 8 years, studied history and religion and peace studies, and then eventually found my way working in the mental health field. And that ultimately led me then back to school, and then I got a master's. And then, after I got my MSW, I thought, well, I'll probably go work in some form of mental health. And, this position came up out of the blue, it seemed, at a place called Downtown Emergency Service Center here in Seattle. At that point, it was a 3-year-old shelter program. It was just a shelter program. It was not anything that it is today.
About what year?
That was 1982.
Okay.
And I think that had begun in 79 as a shelter. And I remember when I first walked into the interview, because I had never, outside of long ago, worked in homelessness whatsoever and had no exposure to services. And I walked in and I just remember feeling strangely at home in this place. And, I wouldn't have said it then, but after some time, I realized that for me, this was my call. And so that's what led me to then this incredibly liberating work that I feel like has been transformational for me in my life. And I don't know how to put words to that exactly, other than it brought me in touch with a realness about life and a grittiness about life that somehow I hadn't been in touch with in the same way before in my own experience or with others. And I feel like I've been given so much, and I feel like I've also contributed a great deal, and it's been a two-way street for sure. And but I just am amazed sometimes how it really was a stumbling into the work. It wasn't like I grew up and said I want to work with these folks, but and I think I had kind of natural tendencies to be open and interested in people. I certainly came with plenty of judgmentalness that it might have been somewhat latent, but it was there. And I feel like one of the biggest transformations for me actually through all of this time has been to allow myself to at least set aside that judgmentalness in a way that has allowed me to be very open to people's experiences and be truly person-centered and meeting people, as we say, where they're at. But that's my story, I guess.
So between that first day that you walked into DESC and now, take me through a little bit of what some of your different roles and jobs have been, what you've done.
Yeah. So initially I was hired as a mental health case manager by King County Mental Health Division. They were at that time funding a few positions, having recognized that a lot of people who were staying in the shelter had some very serious mental illness. So I was part of the DESC mental health outreach team, although outreach there meant just hanging around the shelter and meeting people who were staying there for the most part, although we did go out in the streets a bit and into people's places where they were staying. So I did that for about 3 years and then had the opportunity to be hired on by the nationally funded Healthcare for the Homeless project here locally in Seattle, King County, and thus became employed by Harborview Medical Center, but still remained sited at DESC and pretty much did the same work, but under different auspices. But what was interesting about that is the Healthcare for the Homeless program model of care was so akin to what was needed. It was new, it was innovative, it was somewhat experimental, and terribly humane. I mean, it was sort of like sit down with people, get to know them, learn to know what their issues are, help them with their basic needs, and also then, as you can, help them find stability in housing and in their psychiatric care. These were still times when the idea of best practices had we didn't know what that meant. We were flying by the seat of our pants, but we followed our intuition and met people without being overly judgmental and trying not to reject people and trying to be merciful, if you will, in meeting people. I think the Healthcare for the Homeless model, so I stayed as an employee in that program for the next 15 years then until the year 2000, and did a lot of case management and then also became the supervisor of a mental health team. My job position changed to mental health practitioner. And so in the midst of all of that, I was overseeing a team. I was doing direct service as well. But what then was afforded me was the possibility of beginning to draw upon the resources of Harborview and to go visit people in the inpatient psych units there and to go to in-services and expand my knowledge and my sort of learning there. And then the National Healthcare for the Homeless program had national conferences, and I remember very well the first I presented at the very first national conference, and I had no clue what to say, and I just decided, well, I'm not going to stand there and say, my program does this and this and this. I thought, I'm just going to speak from the heart. And I certainly thought about it and I prepared for it. But I just remember so well kind of talking in ways that really drew upon my experience as well as my beliefs and my values about what does it take to engage with somebody who's so very different and yet so very similar in so many ways. And how do you do that? And I honestly don't remember exactly what I said, but I just remember it resonated well for me, but with the audience as well. And it was sort of like I felt like I belonged all of a sudden when that happened, which was pretty cool. Beyond that then, I was invited to become part of what became a National Healthcare for Homeless Clinicians Network, which was also a really valuable experience. And so I never knew that working in homelessness would lead to so many opportunities, but it truly did. And then, of course, when I left direct service in 2000, and I had just reached a point where I jokingly say I reached my 18-year itch because I had been there actually a full 18 years. But I think what happened is I didn't lose my passion. I didn't lose my values, but I lost my energy, I think, to keep doing the work, which is very, very grueling and also very gratifying oftentimes, but there's a lot of grueling.
Right. So yeah, how did you recognize that? Tell me a little bit more about like when you started noticing the energy.
I think, you know, it was my those 18 years was kind of like riding a bicycle on a road, that somewhat hilly road, and there were peaks, there were valleys, there were times when, you know, I felt like, yeah, this is great. I had good energy. I was able to maintain a sense of patience and true compassion. And then there were times when I just realized that, boy, I just don't have it. And And I think actually it was when I also recognized that I live with my own sort of low-grade depression, if you will. And I remember when, you know, I would be in a position of working with people and suggesting, well, maybe you should get psychiatric care. Maybe you should, you know, have you considered, I mean, I don't know, meds might be helpful to you, you know. But never would have considered that for myself. But
neither of them.
Neither of them. No. Maybe counseling if we didn't call it psychiatric care. But, you know, but here I am many years later still taking my fluoxetine and my, you know, I realize that environmentally it caused depression, but I think it also tapped into something that was already there. And it's interesting because for me that has been also a gift because it, I think one should be depressed when you work in poverty and extreme, you know, the kinds of issues that people face day in and out and the injustices they face. It would be wrong not to be somewhat depressed, and yet you also have to stay alive and well and continue going. And so I'd like to think I found that balance pretty well for a long period of time. But I think what happened is it just got to the point where I felt like, and maybe it was just tapping into a new phase of my life at midlife, thinking, well, maybe there's something else I can do or some other way to contribute. And what's fascinating about that for me is that having left the direct service without having a plan in mind was a really important thing for me to do. And I remember going to a retreat center in Albuquerque, New Mexico, so called the Center for Action and Contemplation. And I didn't need the action at that point. I needed the contemplation.
You'd done the action.
Although we did both. But it was at that point where I needed to just step back and sort of review my life. And I had no regrets whatsoever, but I also knew that I needed to move to a different chapter. And for me, it was one of those periods of just being open to whatever came. And what came was an invitation from the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council, which is based out of Nashville, Tennessee, to come work for them as a training director. But the good news was I could stay in Seattle.
Right.
So that's what I did for, probably 7 years. Did a lot of developing curricula, teaching and training, and that's when I also began to learn more and more about best practices. So motivational interviewing was something I'd been exposed to but hadn't really kind of absorbed it. But I started doing more teaching and training in motivational interviewing. I developed an outreach guide manual for outreach workers around the country, which was really fun to do. And then also got eventually more into sort of just sort of person-centered case management. And I always say case management these days with a sense of putting kind of these quotation marks around it because it's really not a good term. I think planned support or support services or being a recovery specialist or something is probably a better way to think about that. But that is to say that I found for myself that I had some other gifts that I just didn't know I had, and that was that I was able to get in front of a group of people and facilitate a training. And I use the term facilitate very deliberately because this is a quote from someone else, but I don't think there's anything such as teaching. It's only learning, right? And so you create this environment. And for me, that was kind of my style in providing services to people, is create an environment where they could discover for themselves. And that's certainly the motivational interviewing way of approaching things. And teaching also has become that for me, of really creating an environment where people can become thirsty for learning. And I found that actually I have some gifts in that area.
You do, having been a recipient of motivational interviewing training.
Well, thank you.
You had a lot of kind of like problem-based learning and that was very good. So you did that until when?
So about 2007. And then for a variety of reasons, I just felt like maybe it was time to move ahead from that organization. And so there was a newer organization that was being started that included a lot of people I knew from the field. And it became known as the Center for Social Innovation and is located in Needham, Massachusetts. And so I decided to go work for them. And what was so very interesting about that is, as per their name, they were really very committed to innovative kinds of things and had a bunch of sharp staff who were very interested in not only good, solid content, but really nice aesthetics and design, adherence to adult learning principles, certainly basing things solidly in research and experience, a commitment to working with people with lived experience as part of the team, training team as well.
So still a focus on homelessness or poverty?
It's definitely focused on working with people who are marginalized and vulnerable, mm-hmm. and that translates into homelessness and poverty, yeah. I think our reach is expanding a little bit. We're doing a lot of training these days for people living or working in health and human services and in lots of different settings, but mostly whom are working with marginalized peoples. So I think what's happened in the ensuing time is I've now gotten involved in doing a lot of online training as well as on-site training. And I guess at this phase in my life, I'm in my early 60s, I see myself as involved in trying to equip others in the field to continue the work and hopefully to advocate for the needed changes that are very much still needed in the field. But that said, we've come quite a long way from having no best practices to think about to now thinking a lot about trauma-informed care, motivational interviewing, critical time intervention, lots of medical kinds of advances and whatnot. And so my mantra these days is we want to provide training that is person-centered, housing-focused, trauma-informed, recovery-oriented, peer-integrated, and of course we always throw in that self-compassionate piece at the end, right, where we really need to take care of ourselves while caring for others. But we do take that seriously, and that's part of it too. So I've had this wonderful opportunity to get involved in all these very cool projects to develop self-guided curricula as well as faculty-led curricula. And we're working on an MI simulator game through a small business innovation grant.
Oh,
and
that's cool.
So these are things that I never would have dreamt of.
Right.
But they're now things that for me, it makes me happy to be involved in this. And it all goes back and draws upon my direct service experience, which it continues to hold my feet on the ground, I mm-hmm. think. And so, yeah.
So you spoke a little bit of what I guess could be termed burnout of mm-hmm, of some sort, mm-hmm. or at least a change, midlife crisis back in 2000 of looking at where you're going. So and with your current work of having that also in terms of prevention mm-hmm. as part of it. So what do you like personally, and also what do you see other people doing that helps with professional burnout?
Well, I'll start with a story. If my wife were here, she would endorse it. So I've actually developed a fair number of curricula and done a lot of training around what I call, you know, finding resiliency and renewal in our work. And it's actually been something really important to me in finding ways to do that. There was an instance a few years ago when my wife woke up in the middle of the night. It was like 2 a.m. and I was at my desk and she came down and she said, "Ken, what are you working on?" I said, "Well, I'm preparing a self-care training." And that was sort of a light bulb moment for me. But yeah, I think it's been a struggle for me personally. I value it. I know it's important. I know how to tell others how important it is. But I can't tell if it's because I'm a workaholic. I don't want to label myself. I mean, I'm also very committed to my work and I love it. So it's all mixed in there. And it's also part of, we have a saying in my faith background that work and worship are one. And so I just tell my wife, "Well, I'm worshiping while I'm working," right? But it truly has been, it's become an integrated part of who I am. And I don't always see the boundaries. And that's the downside of it. I'm not always sure when work and other living get separated. And that's my struggle. But I will say at the same time that I feel like I've been relatively successful as and I think physical activity is probably as important as anything. And that includes eating and sleeping. But, you know, I think the stress that we hold, the secondary trauma we hold is primarily physical. It's in our bones. It's cellular. And so things like mindfulness practice, certainly for running, bicycling, and just movement have been really important for me. I'm also a person who really values writers and people who inspire me. And so I turn a lot to, you know, some of those good Catholic mystics like
Thomas Merton.
Thomas Merton, for sure. And he actually became very relevant recently when the Seahawks were playing. And it reminded me that do not depend on the hope of results.
Oh, there you go. I think that's the first time I've ever heard Thomas Merton football put together. But okay.
If you're a sports fan, it's a good one to keep in mind.
But
no, I think, you know, Merton and Nouwen and then more recently some of the Buddhist thinking, Thich Nhat Hanh is certainly somebody who really inspires me. And then just, I don't know, I'm reading a book right now called Just Mercy by Stevenson about, you know, if you've read it, it's just amazing. But I realize that my type is I'm drawn to brokenness. And I'm also healed by brokenness in being drawn to it. And for me, that's where I feel most alive. So some people would say, look at that and say, oh, that, I don't want to touch that, right? But for me, it's sort of where I have to find my vibrancy, I think. And it's also related to a fundamental commitment to trying to make a difference in the world in a positive way. Mm-hmm. So that's what makes me feel fulfilled and so to reject that would be silly, you know. Why would I do something else? Now, that's not to say I don't have fun. You know, I love music. I love live music. I love following sports to some degree. I love playing Scrabble. I love good, tasty brewed beverages and friendships that are really important to me, too. So your question was, I think, around caring for self while caring for others. And I think what I would say is, I think each of us has to find our own way, and it has to be some balance of the psychosocial, spiritual, you know, physical kinds of ways of finding ways of exercising ourselves and our minds and our bodies and our spirits. And
right. Well, I think also as I was picking up some of what you're saying is it changes at different points of our lives too, just in terms of our life course.
It really does. And I have to admit that I'm not one who does well to say I'm going to sit down and do a practice on a regularly scheduled basis. I think it's my anti-authoritarian nature is probably what it is. But I'm much more desirous of kind of finding what works in the moment and certainly following some patterns. But I've never been good at going to yoga at 2 a.m. or not 2 a.m.
Your wife would question that too.
6 p.m. on a Tuesday or something, you know,
right.
Although there's some merit in doing that. But I think this idea of self-care is the other important thing I think I've learned is I don't have to find it outside of myself. It's already there. And each of us, I think it's already in our side of ourselves. There's something within each of us is saying, eat, sleep, pray, do all those things. And
buy,
be good
buy
to
a
yourself.
House in Italy.
Well, maybe, yeah. It's interesting. I was talking to someone just yesterday, and you know, there's this old from the Christian tradition. There's this saying that you know we need to love ourselves or love our neighbor as ourselves, rather. And you know, it occurred to me that oftentimes that's exactly what people are doing, but it's because they don't love themselves that they also don't love others.
Mm-hmm.
But they're loving others as themselves, right?
Right.
And that's what creates a lot of brokenness and violence, I think. And so this idea of loving ourselves, I think, is pretty critical and not easily done. And we also tend to seek to care for ourselves from external sources. And I think while they may contribute, it's really what's finding what's inside us. And I mean, there's a wonderful quote by Parker Palmer who says, a question, is the life that you are living the same as the life that wants to live within you? And I think that's the key to self-care in my mind, is finding that sweet spot.
You know? And it sounds like maybe taking time, having some space for solitude to be able to listen to that as well.
Yeah. It's interesting. Our lives are so busy and so full. And I think, as Merton says, that's really a source of innate violence in our lives. And so it's interesting these days, and for a long time now, I've actually been starting most of all the training that I offer to people by just asking and calling people into silence. Because I think that is the foundation for all best practices, where we can quiet ourselves enough from our own anxieties, from our own sense of busyness and distraction, to be in that place where we can truly be present to the other person, which is really at the heart of person-centered care, right? That we listen, that we resist the urge to fix prematurely, at least. And so for me, I believe all of these best practices we talk about all come out of a place of silence and quieting of ourselves. William Miller calls it operating out of the uncluttered mind, William Miller of motivational interviewing. Mm-hmm. So whatever you call it, it's finding that place within ourselves. It's already there. And which, ironically, being in a so-called helping profession, like so many of us are, again, I think the error many times that the trap we fall into is believing that helping means to somehow fill people up like an empty glass, and they have to be filled with hope and information and all this stuff. And I think motivational interviewing, perhaps more than anything, suggests that we need to flip that on its end and recognize that people already have within them pretty much everything they need. Certainly they have hopes and dreams and self-knowledge and motivation, and our job is more to uncover the muck that covers it up and shine a light on it and let people see that for themselves. That's a very radical way of thinking about helping, whether you're a nurse, a doctor, a social worker, an outreach worker. And it's probably at the heart of what everything I do these days is I try to convey that, and including the style in which I teach, is that you already have inside you pretty much everything you need. I don't know. I think we overly rely on information and education as being somehow that if only people would know something, then they would change their lives. And in some cases, that's absolutely true. But in many cases, it's so much more complex than that. And I don't know if there's a guy named William Fortas who was here at the University of Washington who said something like, education is to behavior change as spaghetti is to a brick wall. That it just doesn't stick unless a person's already motivated to take it in. And so I'm rambling a bit, but I think that's kind of, for me, the heart of what is the transformation for all of us as a workforce need to think about, is seeing people as already having, and then therefore they feel more empowered, they feel more valued, and they begin to see themselves differently. And that's the magic, if you will. We have to believe in them and believe that they have this within them. And then, there are all manner of stories out there of people who find a way.
So speaking of that, is there, without getting into, confidentiality kinds of issues, but is there a client situation or staff situation, especially from direct service days, that really stands out to you that you'd be willing to share?
It's a really interesting question, because I would love to have a story to share where somebody made a huge leap and bound into whatever.
Microsoft.
Yeah. As if that's higher up the ladder.
Great.
But I think I have to say that there are a few people who have done that, who probably were relatively new to homelessness, already had a pretty significant support system behind them, and were able to pretty rapidly move ahead. And those actually are people whose many stories I probably don't know because I never heard about them again. Mm-hmm. What I do know and what I have sort of, I guess, just that's kept me going is I've seen many, many people make what are relatively incremental changes in their lives. But I have seen people certainly, for example, move off the streets into housing. I've seen people become employed who I would have sworn would never be employed. I've seen people become psychiatrically clear when I would have never guessed that that were possible. I've seen people actually move from not only surviving in housing but thriving in housing. And the one example I guess I'll share is someone who's very disclosed already. His name is Steven. He's a coworker of mine. But, you know, he's a guy who spent 25, 30 years on and off the streets, in and out of prison, used and sold drugs, struggled with mental illness, you know, just did not have a good life and things were not going well. And whatever it was, and it was not something that happened at one fell swoop, but he eventually came to a point where he decided something had to be changed. And so he went from using heroin regularly to using methadone. He stayed on methadone for many, many years while employed as a colleague, and just recently went off methadone and is now, which created more problems, but new good problems. And but he has gone from person with lived experience who many people would have thought there was very little hope to now being a person who is a leader nationally in the peer advocate movement in helping to both model and provide teaching and training around what it means, what recovery looks like. And that is recovery from not only substances, but recovery around mental health challenges and recovery from homelessness, recovery from trauma, you know, what that whole thing looks like. And so he and a lot of others actually have been part of that journey. One of my regrets in my work, and I didn't know better, but one of my regrets was agreeing with the thinking of the time that people living with major mental illness were basically doomed to live with their symptoms and needed to be caretaken. And, you know, certainly you wanted to give them as best as you can, but there was never any sense that they could become so much more and people living with that illness. They were their illness in the way we looked at them. And I wish I'd known that a lot longer or a lot earlier because I think that how we view people is often how they see themselves and or it certainly it denotes how we talk to them and how we treat them. And so, you know, it's interesting to me. I have this image of a small girl who's sort of got her arms closed and has this very defiant stance in her face. And I'll use it in training. I'll say, so have you ever been this girl for one? But what do you see? And you know, you'll hear she's stubborn, she's defiant, she's dug in, she says, no, I don't wanna. And that's all true. And then I also then say, well, what strengths do you see that she has? Well, all of a sudden she becomes, you know, she's persistent. She's an advocate for herself. She's strong, strong-willed, but in a good way. She knows what she believes. She's not going to back down to anybody. And it's sort of like all of a sudden she becomes the daughter that we all want or the friend we all want, right? And it's just one way of suggesting that we all have choices about how we view people. And I can see somebody as homeless, mentally ill, bedraggled, you know, and that's partly true. And I can also see them as, you know, Buckminster Fuller talks about the idea of who would ever guess that a caterpillar would turn into a butterfly. And I often think, well, can we see people for the butterfly they can become, for the person they might become? And so that's the piece that I wish I had learned earlier on in my career, but it's also the piece now I try to convey that if we see people for the possibilities that they possess and can become, it can be a powerful incentive. And it's not that it's going to make all the difference, but one person can make a big difference. And going back to the story of Stephen, he went through all kinds of social service personnel and saw probation officers and parole officers and social service workers. And he told me at one point, he said, you know, there was one person 10 years ago who I met in Northern California who he just treated me differently. And I just felt really good in his presence. And it just felt like there was something going on. And this was when Steve and I were talking about motivational interviewing. And he was sort of musing whether or not this guy might have had some background in that. And he actually made the effort to recontact this guy mm-hmm. somehow and learned that indeed this had been part of his training. It's not to tout motivational interviewing so much as it's this idea that when people treat you in a respectful, mindful, caring, thoughtful, and believing way, that it makes such a huge difference in people's lives. No, it's not enough. I mean, it also helps to have housing and health care,
right.
You know, all those things.
And jobs.
But you know, often people, the reason they don't change is not because they don't want to. It's because they don't feel confident or able or supported to do that. And that's where we can make a big difference. So, yeah.
So speak a little bit about what you've seen, both in your direct service work and also in terms of your administrative and training and advocacy work, with you coming from a mental health background,
mm-hmm.
the connection of mental health and housing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak a little bit more about that in particular?
Yeah, I think that, as I mentioned, of course, prior to my starting my work in the early 80s, of course, it wasn't much before that we were still blaming moms for people having schizophrenia. So we had come a little bit further than that. But at that point, psychoanalysis was sort of still the central way of working with people with illness. And then behaviorism and cognitive behavioral approaches, that was my training at the School of Social Work. And I still value that very much. But I think what happened is that, and this is my words, it was kind of soulless. There was something missing. And it was sort of based on this mechanistic belief that if you just create the right conditions and people and the right consequences and rewards, that somehow people will go towards the right thing. And again, there's elements of truth in that. But it never really spoke to kind of the internal desires and longings that people had. And I think that was the piece that when motivational interviewing came along in the early 90s, the first book was published in 91, that was a real sea change for me around how I worked with people experiencing mental illness. And I should say co-occurring mental illness and addictions, because that was really mostly what things looked like. So there have been several sea changes, if you will. One was that. That, I think, has the potential and has been transforming the workforce to see people more for their potential and to see them as having inherently inherent worth but also inherent potential. And I think that's really critical. And then the way of working with people is very much a trauma-informed way of having a conversation with people. And so another sea change has been the emergence of what we call trauma-informed care and approaches that really take into account the devastating effects of particularly childhood trauma. And as you and others well know, the impact that that has on brain development, on personality development, on behavior. And once we can begin to see people through the lens of the trauma they've experienced and the impact it's had on them, it at least gives us the opportunity to see them in a more humane way and a less reactive way. Because when people then are in your face and what we would say making demands, what they're really doing is advocating for themselves. And so it's learning to see that people's behavior is driven by a good motive, even though it looks bad. Just as I think a person sticking a needle in their arm and shooting up a drug isn't done to harm yourself, it's done to meet a need. And so if we can see people through the lens of trying to meet a need, that gives us a good starting point to then see them and work with them in a respectful kind of way, at least. So some of the changes include this movement towards a person-centered, motivational interviewing kind of informed approach, trauma-informed care. Another thing, of course, that made a huge change was the emergence of this so-called housing first, change that was dramatic. And it happened over time. And there are times when I think back on my own career in the 80s and 90s and I realize that, well, I was kind of practicing housing first in my own small way and each of us as case managers, because I would try to finagle my way to help somebody get into, you know, housing, downtown usually, and some HUD housing or Seattle Housing Authority housing. And of course, they weren't stable, but I would say, well, I'll be there to support them and we'll do the best we can. But, you know, and sometimes I feel like I probably stretched the truth a little bit in how I presented them. But it was sort of like instinctually, I think we all knew that people are going to do much better if they have a safe, decent, dry place to live that they can afford. And that was better than living in a mass shelter or on the streets. And so it's not like it's a new idea, but it became, through the work of obviously Pathways to Housing in New York City and then DESC here and others who came on board. And so Housing First, it's been mangled a little bit by some people, but its essence is that we don't wait for people to be ready for housing. We expect them to want to have a place that's where they can hang their hat and have a bathroom and place to cook and all that. And then we work with them to help, you know, them discover what it is, what they want to do from here. And it makes perfect sense from a Maslow perspective that you have to help people meet basic needs before they can even consider change in their lives. And so that was a huge change. And I think that made a huge difference in the lives of many people living with mental illness and continues to do so. The other thing that's been huge is this whole, what started out being called the consumer movement, but, you know, what the peer advocate, peer support movement. And it's really taking hold. And I think maybe more than anything else, that created the biggest revolution. I don't think most people would look at it that way, but I think when we started taking serious the voices of people with lived experience and seeing them more as an illness and seeing them as people and began hiring them, began incorporating them into the services we provide, having them represent, you know, the constituency on boards, and treated them as people, basically, then, you know, I think it changed the entire conversation that happened at staff levels, at board levels, or I should say potentially has that. I can't say it certainly has in all cases, but it has that potential. There are still a lot of token kind of programs where we have these token consumers, right? But the programs that have fully embraced involvement of people with lived experience are the ones that are thriving. Now, the not so secret is, of course, is that these are people who are disclosed. They talk about their lived experience. And then there's a whole nother set of us
who are closeted.
Exactly. and in the long run, we're not so different from each other. You know, it's just that some of us are willing to say it out loud and others are still maybe too fearful or for whatever reason, or maybe it's not, you know, it's probably not the same perhaps, at least in degree perhaps, but we all live with frailty. We all live with brokenness. We all live with a need for healing and redemption and forgiveness and all those things. And so, I mean, although I don't want to take away from the fact that it's not like we're all the same. You know, we each come at this differently. And so I just so respect that whole movement. And I mean, it is a movement, but it's also, it's a philosophical value. And I think that has the ability to save the mental health system pretty much more than anything.
Well, and it seems like, at least from my thinking back in my experience, that came in pretty early with Healthcare for the Homeless. I mean, I remember a grant writing back in 1989 when that, at least again, it could be tokenism, but that some of that language of having consumer involvement, meaningful involvement, was all part of it.
No, that's very true. And the community health or the community health centers required a certain number. I think it was 51%, right, of community involvement on the board. Now, that wasn't always interpreted as—
Right, that yeah. could be, yeah, loosely.
And I think it often was token, but the precedent was set, I think. And I think, you know, it took time, but it's really when— And I think you're right, though. That's kind of when things started to take a foothold. And now, of course, we have consumer-run agencies, mm-hmm. and that's their identity. And they're out there providing training and doing research. And so it's come a long way. But yes, that was a start to it all. And, you know, probably even before that, there was some of that involvement. But
right.
but
yeah,
again—
it didn't come out of nowhere. Yeah.
Change takes time.
Right. So yeah. Tell me a little bit, because you were you're employed by Harborview, King County, working at DESC. And that was, during that time, was when Healthcare for the Homeless mm-hmm. came into existence in mm-hmm. King County. And I know King County is fairly unique in terms of how they do healthcare mm-hmm. for the homeless. Can you speak a little bit to that, what you've seen, and especially comparison with some national models?
Yeah. So Seattle, King County was one of the original 19 awardees of a grant, a four-year grant, a renewable grant, that was coming from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Pew Memorial Trust. And there was, to my knowledge, no government money at that mm-hmm. point. And it was a demonstration project. And the idea was to demonstrate whether you could successfully, effectively provide healthcare services, which was also meant to some degree behavioral health services to people experiencing homelessness, whether it be in a shelter, on the streets, or wherever. So of those 19 projects, each one from the very outset kind of developed somewhat differently. Some were ensconced within community health centers, some within hospitals, some within public agencies, some within public health. And here in Seattle, King County, it became, which is typical of Seattle style.
Yeah, here we go. Yeah.
This wonderful patchwork quilt, right? Everybody gets a little piece of involvement in the pie, which was messy, but I think also probably the right way to go in this case. And so you ended up, of course, with people. I think there, I don't know, originally were probably six or seven lead agencies, one of which was Harborview and some other health centers. And then they would hire people and use the funding from Healthcare for the Homeless to place them in a variety of different sites. So I think originally we probably had people in 40 different sites, and I think that's expanded by three or four fold now. I mean, I think, I don't know the numbers, but these days there are folks all over.
mm-hmm.
And of course, there are more facilities out there providing services and care. But that's very different than the model, for example, in places like Baltimore and Denver and a few in Boston, where they are freestanding entities who are very well known in that region as being the healthcare for the homeless program. If you talk to a person on the street here in Seattle, it would be a rare person who would even have heard of that.
Right.
And of course, if you tried to explain it to them, it would take a half hour to figure out, well, so here are the connections.
Right.
You know, so I mean, it's sort of like who wants to? But, you know, I guess the downside of that is that there's not an identity. And so people don't think about healthcare for the homeless, even though there's a King County team and good people who work there, and but they're about, you know, contracts and distributing funds and doing some. Heather Barr, for example, does a lot mm-hmm. of community outreach to shelters and things and public health things. But the upside or the downside, but yeah, I guess the downside is there's no identity. The upside is that I think the reach, you know, is pretty dramatic where people are, and then drawing upon the resources also of these lead agencies is very different than trying to be your own thing. And so it's not – I used to try to tell my parents back in Pennsylvania who I worked for, and, you know, it was this long litany. I never did quite know, but, you know, I worked on site at DESC. But I worked out of Pioneer Square Clinic, which is a satellite clinic of Harborview Medical Center, which is part of Healthcare for the Homeless, Seattle King County, which is part of King County, which is part of the National Healthcare for the Homeless, which is federal funding. I mean, it goes on and on, right? And that's the way life is. I mean, so I think what's happened, I'm not sure this is part of your question, but the sad thing I've been seeing is that there's been a movement towards institutionalization of the healthcare for the homeless model and movement more towards the efficiency models, if you will, that you see in community health centers mm-hmm. and community health centers. And where
the business model.
Yeah.
And
where some of the freedom and innovation has been retained, and it's still there to some degree, I'm a bit removed from it directly, but I'm hearing increasingly how funding sources are dictating sort of this business model. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there's obviously a case to be made for a business model that works. And at the same time, I think most of us would agree that the business model that is prominent in our country just isn't very effective for many people, at least. And that said, you know, I think one of the things we've learned, though, is that it doesn't have to be physician-centered. You know, it can be nurse practitioner-centered, nurse-centered, social worker. I mean, you know, and I think one of the things that the healthcare for the homeless model has demonstrated so nicely is that it takes a team. Mm-hmm. And even though we don't maybe formalize those teams, you know, on any given project, you can be pretty certain there's somebody there who's paying attention to physical health care, medical issues, to behavioral health issues, to housing, to entitlements or income or work or whatever. And more recently, there are peers who are really working alongside people and helping them. And so it's kind of a recreation of the ACT, the assertive community treatment team in some ways. And it's basically, as Craig Rennebaum would say, one of my mentors, it's really creating a community of care for people. And you and I have a community of care that we can name the people in our lives who we turn to for certain things, you know, for formally and informally. And that's exactly what I think the Healthcare for the Homeless model was able to accomplish and is able to accomplish, is creating a community of support and care for people, which was naturally not available
right.
to them through family or otherwise.
Yeah, and one other kind of advantage, I think, from my perspective of the Seattle model versus, for instance, Baltimore, where I've worked, is it's not as stigmatizing. Because mm-hmm. if it's a freestanding healthcare for the homeless clinic, some people are less likely to go because of the stigma of it still.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah.
Although the Seattle model can also be a bit messy at times. So what have you noticed? I mean, even though you're working for an agency that's based in Boston, but you and your wife live here in mm-hmm. Seattle. So what have you noticed or worried about or hoped for in terms of what's going on currently with homelessness right here in our hometown? And also where you live, which is a big issue
yeah.
in your neighborhood.
Yeah. You know, people in the movement, if you will, in this current phase of homelessness, which kind of rekindled in the late 70s, early 80s, I mean, those who have been around a long time know that we all thought homelessness was a short-lived experience mm-hmm. and that we would
end it.
And I actually still believe that could have been possible. So one of the things that dismays me to this day is that in the early 80s, we pretty much dismantled the funding for public housing, which had been there. The HUD budget was decreased by some, I think 79% in the beginning of the Reagan era. A window of vulnerability was declared that we needed to give that money to the Defense Department, and that was all part of that philosophy. I think ever since, we've been pretty much relying on charity work to deal with a huge social problem. And as wonderful as all that charity work is, and I consider healthcare for the homeless as part of that too, although it's moved a little bit more towards social justice work. But I just think, you know, I think of homelessness as a product of a way that a system and an economy that we've set up runs that has fallout. And what's particularly dismaying is that we're now seeing a huge spike with that as the disparities of inequality and the inequality of wealth are just becoming so. I mean, the paper said the other day, 62 individuals have as much wealth as 3.5 billion people on the earth. You know, well, that says something about inequality, and it's not trickling down. I think there's been a, you know, the commitment to housing, while that's not the entire thing, I think we have to make that front and center. And if there were a recommitment to housing, if a social worker or an outreach worker could walk out and talk to people and say, you know, I'd love to show you three different places that could be yours. I'm carrying the keys in my pocket. Would you be interested in looking? I can pretty much guarantee that nobody would say, no, I won't look. There might be one or two who for their own unique reasons would say that. But there is no such thing as choosing homelessness. It's choosing to say, I choose to be homeless because you're saving face. But people don't choose to be wet and dry. I mean, we know that. So all of that to say is that I think, well, and actually in that regard, the 1811 East Lake Project here in Seattle is a wonderful example of 75 units of housing that required talking to 79 people to fill it up, right? Mm-hmm. And two of those had already died, so that doesn't count. And so anyway, this mythology around people choosing to be homeless is just a myth of convenience.
And those were the most hardcore.
Those were the most hardcore
public
alcoholics.
Yeah, public inebriates.
Yeah, they were the most expensive alcoholics in county. So people will choose things if it's something that's reasonable and suitable, and they won't choose something if they feel like they're coerced or if it's not suitable. And so, yeah. So the housing, you know, the incomes, I mean, I am grateful for the movement towards a higher minimum wage. It's not quite a livable wage, but it's inching. But that's good. And yet even so, people certainly now in Seattle can't afford housing on a $15 an hour wage. And so there's some really dramatic things that need to happen. At a variety of levels, I think. But it's the federal level that I think needs to show the leadership and the guidance, and they've really fallen. And I don't need to blame that on any one administration. I think it's just been an ongoing sort of apathy in many ways, or a shirking of responsibility. Obviously, the mental health system is hurting and broken. But if you look at our country today, I mean, there has been precious little investment overall in the last 30 years in the infrastructure. And it's all been sort of military spending and lowering taxes, and that's become the mantra. And we're paying a price for it. And so if you were to ask me if I were hopeful about anything.
Yeah, like what are your hopes for the future? We can't end on the total downer. Like, what are some of your hopes for the future?
It does get discouraging. And at the same time, I think that we can point towards lots and lots and lots of examples of small-scale success stories, including the 1811 East Lake Project is a wonderful example of that. And I, you know, in terms of the homelessness world and mental illness and whatnot, we've seen now plenty of projects that started out as demonstration projects that have proven that if you actually invite people to move into housing under conditions and terms that are acceptable to them, that they'll move in. And then if you invite them, and I'm using the word invite deliberately because none of this is based on coercion, because people don't respond all that well to coercion, I've learned, including myself. But if you invite them to then reconsider or think about their lives and what it is their hopes and dreams are, they will begin coming and saying, would you be willing to take me to detox? Or I think maybe I would like to go see somebody, a counselor, or I need to have somebody look at this lump on my arm. And it's not that, you know, we can certainly nudge them in those directions, but when people make choices, and I think people truly do want to choose that which is to their benefit, their health, their well-being, their integrity, that when we create an environment where they can freely do that without feeling coerced, people will go there. Now, not everyone. People will die also. And some people just, for whatever reasons, it's too far, that the hope is gone. But I still think we all need to operate as if everyone who's breathing has hope. And so I'm always going to look for that and try to shine a light on it, as I think we all need to. But what we already know what to do. It's no mystery. And it wasn't a mystery 30 years ago either. It's just that we've set up systems that haven't figured out how to provide what's truly needed, because we're so bound and tethered to our own ideas about systems and how they should work. But permanent supportive housing with truly supportive services is ultimately, and then surrounding people with people who can pay attention and observe for and have meaningful interactions around their health, their safety, their mental health, their addictions, if they're there, their trauma, you know, and just be real neighbors to them. I think we know that's what's needed. And there are beautiful models out there in lots of different states where people's lives are being transformed by these housing first, permanent supportive housing models that provide real services. And I don't want to oversimplify it, but I mean, that's the heart of the approach if we want to end homelessness. At the same time, it would be really nice if we could radicalize and revolutionize our economy and take a close look at our own capitalist tendencies. And I'm not suggesting we have to throw the whole thing out, but, you know, we have created a capitalism that clearly has lost its soul too. And care for the neighbor, care for the common good is increasingly just, you know, losing credibility as even viable. And it will come back. That's my hope too, that history is like a slinky, you know, it keeps going around and around. It's always a little different, but it keeps coming back. Or maybe it's a boomerang, I don't know. But I guess my hope is in what it was attributed to Martin Luther King, whose birthday we celebrated yesterday, that the moral arc of the universe bends toward justice. Mm-hmm. And it bends slowly.
So I guess it is a boomerang.
Yeah, it's a moral arc. That's right. It bends.
Yeah, it bends.
And as Barack Obama says, we need to help the bending. We need to help bend it. But I mean, I think that's what making a difference is. And, you know, I guess I become most despairing when I think somehow I can't do it all. And that's just all ego, you know, because I can't, obviously.
Right.
I'm one very small part of it. But you are, and others are, and I just believe that collectively there are enough people in the world who are already doing this and are just looking for ways to keep doing it. And some of it's charity work, some of it's justice work. The only reason I don't favor charity entirely is because charity can always be withdrawn at any time, and justice says you have a right to housing, healthcare, these kinds of things, and I think people need to have that.
Nice. So is there anything I have not asked you that you'd like to add at all?
I think I've said enough.
Good? Yeah. Okay. We'll Thank end you. With the boomerang and Martin Luther King.
Yeah, there you go.
Right. Thank you.
It's good enough.
Thank you for taking time today.
Indeed. Indeed. Thanks for asking the questions.